This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And we're back. Labor Day is behind us. The long weekend was the quiet before the storm. And now comes the storm. Congress returns. Kavanaugh hearings begin today. NAFTA talks resume tomorrow. The fight for the midterms goes into high gear. And there's even more. And we're here to talk about it this hour on Point, the week and the political season ahead. Join us on air or online. There is a lot riding on the shoulders and on the integrity and skill of our elected officials on Capitol Hill this week. So do you think the spirit of Senator John McCain will leave its mark on them as the Kavanaugh hearings begin and the fight for control of Congress heats up? With Labor Day in the rearview mirror, what do you hope happens in the NAFTA negotiations this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now from New York is Catherine Rempel, opinion columnist at The Washington Post. Catherine, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
Also with us from Capitol Hill is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Sahil, welcome back to you.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be back.
It's great to have you. And in Washington, Alex Bolton joins us. He's senior staff writer at The Hill. Alex, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got links to all these great journalists' work at onpointradio.org. Well, let's just get started with the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, which begin today. And as soon as they got started, a lot happened. Senators Kamala Harris, Senator Klobuchar, and Senator Blumenthal all interrupted to protest last-minute document dumps last night. And they called for today's confirmation hearings to be adjourned. And no sooner had they protested, hecklers and protesters in the back of the room began shouting. So a lot going on at the confirmation hearings of Judge Brett Kavanaugh today. Here's what Senators Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar said, interrupting Senator Chuck Grassley's introduction.
We have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend
this
a very warm welcome.
We have not
to
been
Judge
given
Kavanaugh
an opportunity to have a meaningful
his wife,
hearing
Ashley,
on this nominee.
There are two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris. Mr. Chairman,
Judge
we received 42,000 documents that we haven't
and
been able
else joining
to review
us
last
today.
Night, and we believe this hearing should
I know
be postponed.
This is an exciting day for all of you.
Catherine, Sahil, and Alex, I'm seeing tweets from reporters who are in the Senate room where the hearings are happening. Adam Liptak, for example, is tweeting, I've covered five other Supreme Court confirmation hearings. None of them included anything like the chaos in the opening minutes of the Kavanaugh hearings this morning. Sahil, let me just start with you. What do you make of how this has all gotten started?
Yeah, this is likely to be one of the most, if not the most contentious Supreme Court confirmation battle in at least a generation. The stakes are enormous. There are two components of this battle right now. One is the procedural aspect, Democrats protesting the fact that there are documents from Kavanaugh's tenure in the White House, where he was both a political operative and a lawyer, that have not been publicly released. Republicans counter that there's been more documents released from him, than any other Supreme Court nominee in recent memory. So that's a procedural aspect. And then, of course, the ideological overlay is absolutely enormous. This is going to be a judge on the Supreme Court who could sit for 30 to 40 years. There could be issues where the Supreme Court has leaned left, like abortion, gay rights, and the death penalty, where Kennedy sided with the liberal flank, that could be reversed if Kavanaugh's on the court. There could be decisions like things on campaign finance, voting rights, and gun rights, that where Kavanaugh could solidify a 5-4 conservative majority for a generation. So there's a lot at stake here, and I think that's why this is going to be so contentious.
Well, Catherine, let me turn to you. I mean, Democrats calling for the confirmation hearings to be adjourned almost as soon as they begin. I mean, is that an effective strategy for them? The hearings are continuing on.
It doesn't seem like Democrats at this point have a route to blocking this nominee. The couple of potential Republican swing votes, moderate Republicans, Murkowski and Collins, have said basically they're in favor of Kavanaugh. So without their deciding to oppose him, it doesn't seem like there's any route for Democrats really to obstruct his vote. So, of course, they're going to try to turn up as much as they can in the hearings themselves in terms of things that could be unflattering, that could potentially sway those moderate Republican votes, that could potentially rile up voters themselves who are very divided on this particular nominee. But again, it seems very difficult for them at this point, and especially given the fact that they are getting these last-minute document dumps, that a lot of documents are being withheld. So whatever negative information might be in those documents that could be fodder for trying to sway public opinion on this nominee, they're finding a little bit out of reach at this point.
In the clip that we just played, we heard Senator Amy Klobuchar talking about receiving 42,000 documents just last night. And of course, last week there was news that the Trump administration, citing executive privilege, is withholding some 100,000 additional documents there. Although, Alex Bolton, we had a conversation on this show just yesterday, and some legal scholars said that in those 100,000 documents that the administration is withholding, you're unlikely to find anything particularly damning about the nominee himself, about Kavanaugh, and that it was just, really documents that might protect executive privilege regarding how the White House operates there. So and is this a tempest in a teacup from the Democrats?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that the vote on Kavanaugh is not going to happen until the end of September. So if there is a bombshell, in these 42,000 documents that were released last night, senators will know about it before the vote actually happens. And as you mentioned earlier, or as the guest just mentioned, the two key votes are Murkowski and Collins, mm-hmm. the two moderate Republicans. They're not on the Judiciary Committee. So, they'll have time to review these documents or if there is any bombshell material there. I think the reason why the Democrats are really focusing on the procedural stuff is because there really isn't anything so far that's emerged in Kavanaugh's writings or in his record or in any of these documents released so far that really invalidate his candidacy for the Supreme Court. There's no smoking gun there that would twist Murkowski or Collins. And at this point, it looks like it's likely that he'll get a handful of Democratic votes. And so what the line has become in recent days from Democrats is, well, what are the Republicans hiding? They're kind of raising this specter of that there's something really bad in the record. But so far, nothing's emerged.
Well, let's take a call here. Go ahead, Catherine. Go ahead.
I was going to say, that said, there are other issues that we haven't even talked about that could potentially sway at least public opinion on Kavanaugh that maybe could be revealed within these documents or otherwise, including, besides abortion rights, his view of executive power, his view of the Mueller investigation, whether he is likely to recuse himself or not from any kinds of decisions that might come up before him related to the Mueller investigation and to Trump. So there are a lot of other live issues here that could potentially factor heavily in today's hearings and going forward. We may or may not get any light shed on those kinds of issues from the documents, but you could imagine that there will be continued hammering away on those topics.
Well, and also
the public opinion aspect, if I could just add briefly,
sure.
is fascinating here. There's a new Washington Post ABC poll out today that shows Kavanaugh slightly underwater in public approval for confirmation. That's extraordinary because there's been no other Supreme Court nominee in the 21st century who's been underwater in approval for confirmation. It shows you how contentious this is. Even Harriet Myers, the Bush nominee, who was eventually withdrawn because she had such little support, even among conservatives, was in positive territory. So this is an unusual moment we're in.
Yeah. So let's ask another quick question about why the Democrats are so focused on the documentation around Kavanaugh. Because, Alex, to your point, he does have an incredibly long paper trail. He's been sitting on the D.C. Circuit Court for 12 years, White House lawyer formerly. Lots of stuff to grapple with regarding his record. But I think, if I recall correctly, Senator Pat Leahy and Dick Durbin in 2006, when Brett Kavanaugh was being confirmed for the D.C. Circuit Court, they asked him what he knew about the Bush administration's decisions regarding the war on terror, right? Especially specifically what he knew about the treatment and, torture of detainees. And I think Leahy and Durbin are concerned that Kavanaugh may have misled them in those 2006 confirmation hearings, and perhaps they're seeking more information about that within these documents.
That's certainly possible, and I will find out whether that emerges in the weeks ahead. But it hasn't yet.
Right.
And I mean, again, the point I made earlier, there is still another month to get through this stuff. But I think the conclusion when what Kavanaugh said at the time when he was confirmed for the D.C. Circuit is that he was not involved in those talks, and so if he's found to have lied to the Senate, that would be very problematic. And so maybe that's what the Democrats have in mind when they say when they insist that there's something being held back, being hidden. I spoke to Pat Leahy last week, and his parting words before leaving for the weekend is, "What are they hiding? We need to find it out." So he may have that in mind.
I mean, Catherine, they've turned that into a hashtag. What are they hiding? I mean, but again, I turn back to what Alex was saying, Catherine. The senators who are going to vote on Kavanaugh's confirmation, beyond those on the Judiciary Committee, I mean, as Alex rightly points out, they are going to have a little bit of time to look through all these documents.
They will, and maybe they'll find something, maybe they won't. In the meantime, I'm sure Democrats will be doing their darndest to try to find something that looks like a smoking gun or that points to Kavanaugh's views on some of the issues that they think voters, particularly Democratic voters, but maybe moderate Republican voters as well, care about, whether it's Mueller, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, views of executive power in the regulatory state. There are a lot of issues that could be big issues in the midterms, including health care, that even if there isn't something that comes out of these documents that suggests, oh, Kavanaugh lied to the Senate or did something else that would be construed as improper, it might still reflect some greater, it might still shed some greater light on his views on issues that Democrats find important. And yes, in the next month, maybe they'll uncover something like that that could as well feature heavily in these discussions.
Yeah, well, today in the opening day of the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, said, "I really regret this, but I think you have to understand the frustration on this side of the aisle." Well, we are talking about what to expect this week in the news, and we'll talk a little bit more about Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings when we come back. Catherine Rampell joins us. She's opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Sahil Kapoor is with us, national political reporter for Bloomberg, and Alex Bolton, senior staff writer at The Hill. Lots more when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a biweekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what to expect this week in the news, and there's a lot that's happened already, namely the kickoff of the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh got off to a rocky start here, with a number of Democrats requesting a vote to delay the hearings. Judiciary Chairman Senator Chuck Grassley has refused to hold that vote, and he's also said that Democratic complaints about the late release of 42,000 documents regarding Kavanaugh that were given to the committee yesterday, he says that this process has been very transparent so far, and that a number of those documents are available to the general public at large on the Judiciary Committee, Judiciary Committee's website. So a lot to discuss there. And we're joined today by Catherine Rampell. She's opinion columnist at The Washington Post. Sahil Kapoor also joins us, national political reporter for Bloomberg. And Alex Bolton is with us, senior staff writer at The Hill. And let's get a call here. Mark is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Mark.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I think your panel is missing the greater context, and the very large elephant in the room is Merrick Garland and the fact that Obama's appointment, legitimate appointment, February of 2016, not only did he not even get a vote, he wasn't even given a hearing. And I think that has deeply poisoned the well Certainly someone like myself has not forgotten that. It's shifting the balance of the court. Not only is Trump getting one nominee, which he would have with Kennedy's retirement, but two. And I think that's really, I think, you know, the basis of a lot of this anger that you see from the Democrats in the maneuvering. And, of course, eliminating the filibuster. I mean, there's all sorts of things Republicans have done that are really massive power moves.
Hey, Mark, so point well taken, and I'm going to get the panel to respond here. But do you think that the further pull, I don't know if you see what the Democrats are doing now as simply a response to that or a further politicization of this process. And if so, I mean, is that the right way to go, or is that further just bog down governance in America?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. I mean, my understanding is Supreme Court nominees used to be passed through in a day or two. It would be very early process in the early part of our country's history. But, I mean, it is unfortunate, but I think there's also so much anger in the base that I think perhaps the senators feel obligated to make, to put up as much resistance as possible without otherwise they look like they're rolling over. But I don't think we should forget what Mitch McConnell did. It's the proudest moment, apparently, he says, of his time in office. To block a legitimate appointee in 2016. I think it has deeply poisoned the well.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Sahil Kapoor, respond to that, the shadow of the GOP's treatment of Merrick Garland here.
I think the caller is spot on that there is an enormous amount of bitterness lingering among Democrats over the way Merrick Garland was treated. There had not been a precedent in the past to prevent a Supreme Court nominee in an election year. This was Mitch McConnell deciding that he did not want Merrick Garland to get a hearing or to get a vote, and he was successful at blocking him. Garland notably had far more public support then than Kavanaugh does now. I'm looking again at the ABC Washington Post poll that I mentioned. It was 46% support for Kavanaugh, 30% for Garland. 30% opposition to Garland. Kavanaugh is 38% support right now and 39% opposition. One of the reasons Obama nominated Garland was that there were Republicans like Senator Orrin Hatch who had said nice things about him, and that isn't really the case with Kavanaugh, who is expected to be a very conservative justice, more so than Anthony Kennedy, and to, you know, tilt the Supreme Court to the right. So, yes, I do think that, the anger among Democrats and the opposition among Democrats has a lot to do with the way Merrick Garland was treated.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not just Merrick Garland, by the way. I mean, Merrick Garland was the highest profile of the judges that Republicans blocked, nominated by Barack Obama. But there were lots of other federal court nominees that Republicans basically stole from President Obama. And Trump has boasted that he has put so many new people on the federal bench. I don't know if it's a record number, but I'm sure he has made that claim at some point. But the reason why he's been able to put through so many of his own nominees on the federal bench at the district level and the circuit level has to do with the fact that those were slots that Obama was essentially denied. So, yes, there's a lot of resentment amongst Democrats who follow this issue. And there's a question of, well, if Republicans are willing to play dirty, why aren't Democrats willing to play dirty to fight fire with fire? Of course, as I said earlier, it's not clear what tools Democrats would actually have at their disposal at this point, given that they do not control any branch of government to basically, use the same kinds of weaponry against a Trump nominee, whether on the Supreme Court or elsewhere.
Alex?
Well, I would like to point out that, you know, this partisanship has been going on for a while. I mean, what the Republicans talked about, you know, during the Garland consideration when they blocked him, and I think, Democrats were infuriated by that. But the Republicans pointed to a floor speech that Vice President Biden, you know, made back when he was serving the Senate in 1992. He said that if then President Bush were to nominate a justice retired and Bush were to nominate a replacement before the 1992 election, that the Judiciary Committee would not hold hearings. And so that is something that Republicans pointed to, I think, when they blocked Garland. Not saying that what the Republicans did was justified, but that I'm not sure if the roles were reversed, it wouldn't have been, you know, the exact same. If Democrats controlled the Senate, let's say Garland never happened, if Democrats controlled the Senate and, you know, Trump appointed a conservative justice, I think they probably would have bottled him up too. And I think the bottom line here is that you've got to win elections. If you don't win elections, you don't get to influence the process. And I think that's why Barack Obama, when he is going to deploy on the campaign trail later this week, week at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's going to say, people, you need to vote. That's why we're in the situation we're in.
So let me just jump in here, though, because since you mentioned that so-called Biden rule, which is how it's been referred to, I mean, then-Senator Joe Biden gave that floor speech in June of 1992. And just to be clear, as far as I understand, there was actually no Supreme Court vacancy to fill at that time, no nominee to consider, and the Senate never actually even took a vote to adopt any kind of rule to delay. But he did give this speech. But again, for clarity's sake, I don't recall Senator Biden arguing for a delay until the next president began his term, as happened with Merrick Garland. But that the nomination process should be put off until after the election. So it's different than what Mitch McConnell actually did with Merrick Garland.
Well, I think what McConnell said, though, is, you know, had Hillary Clinton won the election, he would have scheduled a hearing on Garland or whomever Clinton's nominee was. And I believe that. I think that's pretty clear. It was just that he did not want to have this, you know, when the Republicans had the White House within their grasp, he didn't want to, you know, give it the Democrats kind of a free Supreme Court nominee. And he said that, look, if after the election, I will hold hearings on this. So had Hillary won, and the Republicans maintained control of the Senate, there would have been hearings on her nominee.
Right. Well, so, you know, really what we're talking about now is still white hot, intense partisanship on Capitol Hill. And it's interesting because we have the backdrop of how we began this week over the weekend with Senator John McCain's funeral and, you know, people rightly lauding him and remembering him as an American hero and now an increasingly rare kind of American politician and one that even, you know, he held his beliefs very strongly but was willing to cross the aisle at times. And so I want to just play a couple of clips from Senator McCain's funeral. First, here is his daughter, Meghan McCain. She delivered a very powerful eulogy for her father at the National Cathedral on Sunday, weeping at times, and also other times speaking with anger and contempt. And here's a particular line that got her sustained applause.
The America of John McCain is generous and welcoming and bold. She is resourceful and confident and secure. She meets her responsibilities. She speaks quietly because she is strong. America does not boast because she has no need to. The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again because America was always great.
Meghan McCain there speaking at Senator John McCain's funeral. And I misspoke a little earlier. His funeral at the National Cathedral was on Saturday. And on that same day, President Barack Obama also delivered a eulogy. And he seemed to measure not only President Trump against John McCain, but also taking Congress's measure as well. And he spoke of the key role of Congress and of, what, you know, basically is folks who know neither victory nor defeat. And he seemed to be talking about perhaps a GOP that was too afraid to stand up to the president.
So much of our politics, our public life, our public discourse can seem small and mean and petty, trafficking in bombast and insult and phony controversies and manufactured outrage. It's a politics that pretends to be brave and tough, but in fact is born of fear.
So, Sahil Kapoor, reflect with us on this. I mean, a lot of people were quite moved by the words they heard at Senator McCain's funeral. But here we are just a couple of days later, and it seems that we're back to business as usual in Congress.
Right. And one of the interesting things about the McCain funeral was that many people spoke. I believe not a single one of them mentioned President Trump by name. These were all odes to, you know, humility and civility and decency, patriotism, statesmanship, bipartisanship. But it was widely perceived as a critique of the president. And that's a remarkable thing in and of itself to consider. Now, one thing President Obama, you know, said in his speech about McCain was essentially that McCain recognized that some things were, you know, more important than winning elections. And this goes back to a moment that a lot of people were talking about just a few weeks before the 2008 election, where McCain stood up to someone at a rally who made a racist comment about President Obama. That's something that a lot of people have been thinking about, especially in the context of this hyper-polarized moment that we're in.
Yeah. Catherine, your thoughts?
You know, I think it's pretty striking that a lot of people heard these sort of general abstract platitudes about decency, American values, standing up for the little guy, and they heard that as an indictment of Trump.
Hmm.
You know, Meghan McCain's comments aside, she clearly was referencing the Trump campaign slogan about making America great again. But these other comments from George W. Bush and from Barack Obama, you know, these were just sort of generic levels of praise that one speaks about a great man. And I don't know that they were actually intended to be an indictment of Trump, given that they were, again, sort of platitudes about a great man and about putting country ahead of party, ahead of one's own interests. I think the greatest indictment of Trump, in fact, is the fact that his supporters heard those comments as critiques of the man in the White House.
Catherine, if I may, I mean, you don't think that President Barack Obama knowingly said those things in this context and didn't think that it was a direct indictment of views as the president's behavior?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I think if we had somebody else in the White House, Barack Obama very well could have delivered those same comments about John McCain being a hero, putting country ahead of party, of election victories. He still could have made those same comments and they still would have rung true because they reflected on the life of a great man. Mm. Again, it was ambiguous. And the very fact that people heard that as a definitive critique of Trump, more so than praise of the man whose life was being celebrated, I think is very telling. We don't know whether Obama was deliberately trying to impugn the character of Trump. He may have been, but those words taken on their own need not necessarily be an indictment of the guy in the White House so much as praise of the person, again, who had recently passed.
Right. I mean, but Obama did say trafficking in bombast and insult and phony controversies and manufactured outrage. Alex,
yeah, but he talked about similar things when he was in the White House. You know, he faced bombast and outrage and attacks on his character and his supposed tyranny from Republicans who were opposing him from Capitol Hill at the time. So, again, it's ambiguous. I really do think it is. And the fact that people heard it the way that they did, I think, is very telling.
I mean, so your point taken, I mean, there's a very, very strong argument to be made that American political discourse has been broken down for quite some time. I mean, Alex Bolton, your thoughts?
I think it's pretty clear he was referencing Trump. Trafficking in bombast and insult, I mean, that's clearly Trump, a reference to Trump, and I think most Democrats on the Hill would agree with that. Now, Catherine raised a good point. It is ambiguous exactly what he's saying because the president, Obama is not using Trump's name, and this has become, I think, a gripe on the left that the Democrats are always taking carrying butter knives to gunfights. I mean, you know, you have Trump calling out Jeff Sessions over the indictments of Duncan Hunter and Chris Collins, you know, two sitting Republican lawmakers with a litany of offenses that are, I think, pretty well evidenced. And, you know, Trump and then Obama, you know, at this funeral makes kind of an oblique reference. And of course, it is a funeral and, you know, some decorum has to be kept. But let's also keep in mind that, you know, John McCain was the fiercest critic of President Trump on Capitol Hill. He pointedly asked for Trump not to attend his funeral. He called his performance during the Helsinki summit disgraceful and the summit itself a tragic mistake and all sorts of criticism. So the fact that Obama is making these comments at this funeral, I think it's definitely directed at Trump, but it's oblique. It's not that clear. It is a little bit vague, and so someone could say, well, this would be appropriate at any time, and you know it's a little bit hard to argue otherwise because we don't know what exactly is in Obama's head. But I think what we're seeing here, though, is some dissatisfaction because of moments like this, dissatisfaction on the left over what they see as kind of the feckless tactics of the Democratic Party. And that's why I think there's so much pressure being put on Democrats in the Senate today to be tougher on Kavanaugh. And I think that's why you're seeing these theatrical performances at the hearing, because the Democrats need to show their base that they are tough. Otherwise, they have a Tea Party movement on their hands. There's an insurgency possibly at stake.
When we come back,
the base aspect, I think, is critical looking ahead to the election. Democrats are likely to fail here in stopping Kavanaugh. They know that. There's still a chance, but it's not likely to happen. What they can do if they fail is to energize and mobilize their base and get them to show up in the midterm elections and flip the Senate, which would have an enormous impact on future judicial and executive appointments.
Yeah, I mean, what I was going to say is, as Catherine said a little earlier, that the midterm race may be really what they're focusing on, because not being the party in the majority in any branch of government, it's all they have. I mean, they can make procedural moves and make a lot of noise, but they're not going to be in the decision-making seat unless something profound happens this November. So when we come back, we're going to talk a lot more about that, about the midterms and where we are now in the primaries as they roll across the country in advance of November. We're talking about the news this week and what we have to deal with already on a Tuesday and what's to come between now and the end of the week. I'm joined today by Catherine Rempel and Sahil Kapoor and Alex Bolton, and we definitely want to hear from you. What's your question for our great roundtable of journalists, and what do you think is going to happen in the midterms this November? What have you seen? Have you seen any kind of meaningful pattern in the primaries? And we also want to talk about NAFTA negotiations as they continue on. What do you hope to come out of these NAFTA negotiations? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about all the week we've already had, all the news, I should say, we've already had this week, plus what could come as we grind through Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I'm joined today by Catherine Rempel. She's opinion columnist at The Washington Post, and by Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg. And Alex Bolton is also with us. He's senior staff writer at The Hill. Definitely want to hear from you on what your thoughts are about what you heard at Senator John McCain's funeral. What do you think that says about American politics, and particularly perhaps the American Congress today? And given that, what do you see coming up, or the possibilities coming up, as we get closer to these midterm elections in November? So let's go to a caller here. Charlene is calling from Stonewall, North Carolina. You're on the air, Charlene.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. What do you want to say?
I want to say that a friend of mine told me many years ago that balance and weight is what you need when you're flying a plane. Our nation is a huge plane that needs a balance in what we think and what we do and how we succeed. In my opinion, at this point in time of our history, we really need to get out and vote. All of us need to go out and vote. And I'm hoping fervently that the Democrats will be able to achieve more balance as we soar into the next decade.
Charlene, thank you so much for your call. Catherine Rempel, Charlene's phone was a little hard to hear there, but she was talking about that in order to fly a plane, you need balance and weight. And she sees that that metaphor working for America as a nation, balance there, and hoping that, in Charlene's words, that the Democrats turn out for the midterms in November. And I'm wondering what you think about that, because just before the break, we were talking about how Democrats could have sort of an insurgency on their hands in November. But historically, hasn't turnout favored the GOP for midterm elections?
Yes, in particular because older voters tend to be more heavily Republican, and older voters are much more reliable voters. So I think a large challenge for Democrats this time around is getting younger people out to vote, as well as getting, you know, the usual members of their base out. And there does seem to be a lot of energy amongst Democrats this year, as particularly relative to previous midterm years. But they do have a lot of things going against them. Even if they have high turnout, Republicans have gerrymandered many districts around the country where they control the Republican state house. Democrats have done this in the past, too, but Republicans control a lot of state houses this time around, so that weighs heavily against Democrats. And there have also been a lot of voter suppression efforts in recent years related to cutting back polling places, cutting back hours. So those kinds of factors are much more likely to affect the marginal voter, i.e. the Democrat who does not normally vote in a midterm race. Mm. So yeah, I mean, Democrats are certainly trying to put a lot of energy into getting their people out to vote, because this will probably come down to turnout at this point, but they do face some major tailwinds nonetheless.
Well, let's get a call here on that point. Carol is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Carol.
Hi, Meghna. Just as your guest was saying, getting out the vote, I think, is really important. And I play with a blues band here in Boston, and we live in a little blue bubble, and we were just thinking we need to get out and we need to do something. So we are on a little self-launched tour. We're driving from Maine to Ohio, and we're playing free concerts in districts where there's contested races. We're donating our time and we're getting the venues, and we're hoping that will make a little bit of a difference.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. Since Carol is from Boston, Massachusetts, and I should note we're actually having a primary day in Massachusetts today, and there's a particular race that's garnered a lot of national attention, and that is in the district that's currently held by Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Now, he's facing a primary challenge from Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley. Now, she's a 44 and the first Black woman ever to serve on the Boston City Council. Capuano is a 10-term congressman. Now, politically, there is basically no daylight between them. They are both progressive Democrats in a progressively Democratic district here. But really, it's a question that comes down to approach and who. One of the candidates say they're going to work with the system, and another one says she wants to upend it. So here's a little tape from them yesterday and this morning telling voters what they think this election is all about.
You can either choose to elect someone that knows how Washington works and will keep it working the way that it is, or to elect someone that's going to go to Washington and bring the people of this district with them and change the way that Washington works.
I think it'll be an affirmation of the work that I've done and the way I've approached this, being open, being progressive, being willing to embrace different people across this district. I think it's an affirmation of that.
You're hearing Congressman Michael Capuano and Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley today, who are facing each other in the Massachusetts primary today. Sahil Kapoor, let me ask you about this, because I would say before Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in New York, not a lot of people outside of Massachusetts were paying attention to this congressional race, but all of a sudden it's on the front page of the New York Times, etc. But, I mean, I could talk to you a lot about it because I've covered it a lot here in Boston, but how is this race being viewed in Congress?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten a lot of attention in part because it in many ways mirrors the primary between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Joe Crowley, where she had that extraordinary upset victory. Now, this gets to one of the big dynamics inside the Democratic Party right now that we're seeing in elections. There is an ideological component that can be debated. You know, some factions of the party are interested in Scandinavian-style democratic socialist ideas, but that doesn't seem to be happening across the board. One big factor here is demographic. The Democratic base wants candidates that that look more like them and that reflect the changing face of the party. And as you saw in New York with Ocasio-Cortez, she was a minority. She was young. She was a woman. She was facing a Democratic opponent who was none of the above. Now, that's the same dynamic we see with Ayanna Pressley and Michael Capuano. So I think that demographic pull is an important thread that's happening in Democratic primaries.
Yeah, if I may, I'll just want to bring a little bit of my own reporting to this, because I have followed this race rather closely and spoken with both candidates extensively on a number of occasions. And there are some particular differences, right? I mean, like this is a district that's a majority-minority here, the district that they're running for in Massachusetts. But more importantly, there's no real policy differences between Michael Capuano and Ayanna Pressley, whereas there were between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Joe Crowley. But Alex Bolton, I want to ask you a question here, because one thing which, for example, Ayanna Pressley has actually kind of gotten mad at me about when I have asked her about it in the past couple of months is this question of, she keeps talking about bringing a new approach, and that's what Sahil was talking about a little earlier, like, does the Democratic Party need new faces for those new approaches? And she really bristled at me when I asked her about, you know, if this really was a question of race, and was the future of the Democratic Party one that had to do more to help elect people of color. She didn't like that because she doesn't want to be necessarily defined by that. And I wonder if that's, again, sort of an indication of the tension within the party itself. You were saying earlier that there could be this insurgency for Democrats in November. But on the other hand, Michael Capuano got the endorsement of the Congressional Black Caucus. So I'm not quite sure how these tensions get resolved within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think they're going to come to the fore in the presidential election, because looking ahead to 2020, and by the way, this Kavanaugh hearing today is a showcase for the 2020 presidential election. You have two prominent contenders on there, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, both African-American, and both, because they're African-American, I think have a very good chance of you know, winning the primary in 2020, just because, as Obama showed in 2008, that African-American vote is very important, especially if it coalesces behind one candidate. I don't think you can completely divorce you know, race and gender from these you know, elections. I mean, identity politics is very powerful, whether we want to admit it or not. You know, President Trump has openly embraced it, but I think, you know, there is some of that going on the Democratic side too. But more so, however, I mean, that's one thing. But the other thing is also boldness. I mean, I think that there's I used the word feckless earlier. I think there's a dissatisfaction amongst the Democratic base that they see that their leaders in Washington are somewhat feckless. And here's Capuano, who's been there a long time and much of it in the minority. So I think the question is, you know, we need people who are going to actually, you know, put us in charge and get us the things we want to get. I mean, if Democrats were in the House majority, would we be having this conversation right now? I don't think so. So I think it's the lack of results, just like in any enterprise, makes you want change. And then they gravitate to the candidates who are promising big, bold things, even though whether they can deliver it or not is a big question mark.
Right. Catherine, I think
there's,
go ahead.
I think there's another aspect of all of this that was revealed in the clip that you played that we haven't exactly touched on, which is this idea of running against Washington and the establishment. And it's not just about our party has been feckless and hasn't gotten results. It's that the entire system is bad and all of D.C. is bad. Candidates from both parties have been running against Washington and running on a bill of change for as long as I can remember. I mean, Obama, in fact, ran on change we can believe in, right? And we saw this certainly in the 2016 presidential election as well, this idea that the establishment is bad and needs to be upended. Washington is terrible. And if you look at polling data, there's a reason why so many candidates run on that message. Americans hate Congress and they hate Washington. So, you know, the insurgents are going to have the stronger hand, particularly on that issue, at least, because even though there's forever been this incumbent advantage in these races, there's so much anger about the way Washington works and how it doesn't work, in particular for the little guy, that if you are challenging an incumbent, that can still be a powerful message.
Yeah, Catherine, can I just jump in here? Because I think you made an extraordinarily important point, but it also, it's something that, I don't know, I kind of struggle with. I feel like the American voter, especially because the opinion, as you said, of Washington, particularly Capitol Hill, is so low, right? That outsiders are going to have a popular message, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, saying that we want to upend Washington. You're right. We've been hearing this message for every election cycle for a generation, practically. But then on the other hand, voters also tend to love their incumbents, right? Because they get those key committee chairs. They get they bring the pork home. And so I just wonder.
There is tension between those two things. But, there's less pork today than there used to be. So the advantages of being an incumbent may be a little bit weaker than in the past. And beyond that, again, you still have this sort of populist insurgence against the elites, against the establishment, that has been very strong basically since the financial crisis. And so I think that force has been growing stronger and stronger and could theoretically put at greater risk those once safe incumbents. And we saw this in New York, and maybe we'll see it in Boston, but we're seeing it in a lot of races around the country.
Well, I want to get one more call in here if I can. Diane is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Diane.
I'm calling because you mentioned NAFTA earlier in the conversation. I worked on the NAFTA agreements for the automotive industry, and I think they've produced more or less what they promised. And I'd like to understand why there is so much negative feelings about NAFTA. I think they've actually worked very well to integrate the U.S., Canadian, and Mexican production for the automotive industry, both for the cars themselves and for the components that go into them. And why is it so viewed so negatively?
Now, Diane, just a quick question. You said you worked on NAFTA for the automotive industry. In what capacity?
I was one of the people on a panel of representatives for the automotive industry that proposed and reviewed different iterations of tariff levels and of the percentage of cars that must be made in X, Y, or Z in order to be considered produced in that country and so on.
Yeah, okay. Well, Diane, thank you so much for your call. Sahil Kapoor, NAFTA is still not resolved yet, and there is potentially a possibility that a deal is reached that leaves Canada out. Your thoughts?
Right. So antipathy for NAFTA around the country mirrors general antipathy for globalization in communities that have been negatively affected by it, right? You see a shuttered plant, you see lost jobs in your community, and you want to blame something, and NAFTA has become a flashpoint for that because it kind of opened up trade between these three countries. Now, President Trump is eager for a victory here on NAFTA. He campaigned heavily on, you know, upending that trade deal, making different kinds of trade deals that, in his view, would be much better for the United States. This has obviously been a bumpy process. It's not gone particularly well, and it's not clear what the light at the end of the tunnel is. That we do know that the United States and Mexico have resolved many of their differences, but the United States and Canada have not quite done that, and it's still the contours of a three-country deal that would meaningfully change NAFTA are far from clear. The issue of cars, your caller mentioned automotive. This is a major issue here because President Trump is threatening to slap tariffs on automotive or autos that are sold in the United States that are not made here by a significant amount. So that, you know, is a big point of dispute.
Well, Sahil, I just want to jump in here and just let folks know that we're actually going to talk about the automotive industry and NAFTA specifically tomorrow on this program for the whole hour. I mean, Alex and Catherine, we've just got 30 seconds each for both of you to give us your quick take on NAFTA. And Alex, let's start with you.
Well, I think what's interesting is over the weekend, you have Richard Trumka kind of defending NAFTA. I mean, the president of the AFL-CIO saying that, well, Canada should be part of this deal. Let's remember back in 1994. The AFL-CIO hated this deal. Mm-hmm. So it shows that actually maybe it's not been so bad for the country.
Right. I mean, Trump is saying that the economies of the three countries are integrated, the three countries in North America, and we haven't seen whole chapters of the new NAFTA deal yet, and we're anxious to move forward with it and anxious to have all three countries involved. Catherine Rempel, your thoughts?
Look, with any trade deal, there are widespread but diffuse gains. There are mutual gains from trade, but there are highly concentrated losses in the communities that have been hurt by factories moving to Mexico, etc. And NAFTA did not adequately address those losses. But that said, trade is generally viewed as a positive thing, and there is modernization that needs to happen in this deal that hopefully will happen. But it's not clear that that's what is at the forefront of Trump's agenda here.
Right. Well, Catherine Rempel, opinion columnist at The Washington Post, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Always great to have you, Sahil. Thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
Alex Bolton, senior staff writer at The Hill. Wonderful to have you on our panel today. Thank you so very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
And listeners, this is just Tuesday. So keep your comments coming on what you think is going to happen for the rest of the week and your opinion on all the week's news at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.